How do you take that old, the core of the old experience, but cut away everything that isn't central to it? Which means, like, you don't need the big building. You don't need the tellers standing idle all day long. You need the human contact. You need the interaction to be good. You need to show respect for the customer everywhere that you meet them. So you take that human heart and then you kind of like move it into this new tech-enabled world. That's our job.
Barefoot Innovation starts right now.
Welcome to today's show. I enjoy every guest on Barefoot Innovation, but if someone forced me to choose favorite episodes, today's would be on the list. That's partly because my guests, who are the co-founders of Bee, were incredibly fun to talk with and incredibly thoughtful. And it's also because they're addressing one of the objections that people raise about fintech, which is the idea that it's only for millennials. Bee was founded in June of last year by Vinay Patel and brothers Max and Alex Gassner as an outgrowth of One Financial Holdings, which is a venture-backed laboratory for innovation in retail financial services. Bee is specifically targeting the lack of quality services for low and moderate income and underserved people, although they do point out in our discussion that the terms underserved and underbanked are words that people actually never use in describing themselves. The Bee product is intended to function as an alternative to a checking account structured as a prepaid card that's paired with a mobile app, working with their bank partner, Community Federal Savings Bank. Part of what makes this interesting is Bee's specific hybrid model for personal touch combined with high tech. They're trying to put the human beings where they think customers need them the most, which is in explaining and opening the account. And then they're trying to drive down costs overall by not providing branches and tellers for routine functions. So their team goes in person into underserved neighborhoods in New York and San Francisco initially, and they set up eye-catching mobile kiosks, which they compared to food trucks. They get people interested in coming over, and then they help them through a thorough process of thinking through their needs, opening up the account, setting up and learning to use the app, and then often letting their new customers stay on to take advantage of the Bee Wi-Fi hotspots, since a lot of these consumers don't have easy access. The in-person sign-up process, they also point out, helps guard against money laundering since people are being seen face-to-face. I think you'll be fascinated by Max and Vinay's insights into these consumers, including their huge financial savvy, how thoroughly they know their money situations, and how they do things like optimizing their spending on their phones. It's also interesting to hear about the challenges of working with such a wide array of phones, often finding that some of them are broken or old, which really puts a burden on the Bee team. Vinay and Max also talk about their customers' worries about both pricing uncertainties and payment delays, which are issues being tackled by other innovators that we've talked with on Barefoot Innovation as well. One theme is the company's commitment to treating these customers with respect by providing a product that is obviously very high quality, right down to the thickness of the card, and also their obsession with providing a truly fantastic user experience on the app. They say that customers often take selfies at the end of the setup process with the Bee team. Bee's CEO is Vinay Patel, who has a joint law degree and MBA from NYU and spent 5 years teaching at NYU Business School and at Columbia Public Policy Business School, and then moved on to McKinsey as a consultant to banks and government. Max Gassner has a background as an investment stockbroker on Wall Street starting in 2007, which is part of what motivated this work. He talks movingly about it in our conversation. He has worked in the Bay Area at an artificial intelligence company, Prior Knowledge, and then moved on to a tech company, which eventually morphed into Salesforce. We recorded this episode several months ago, and since then the company has grown and it has also won national recognition in June in New Orleans at the Emerge Conference as one of the winners of the Financial Solutions Lab competition that's run by the Center for Financial Services Innovation and funded by JP Morgan Chase. And we have more information on both them and the other winners in the show notes. Max and Vinay are eloquent about the need for regulators to allow space for robust innovation, arguing that just one startup could create a 10x breakthrough that could change people's lives everywhere. And they're also very thoughtful on their commitment to earning compelling returns for their investors. They aim to do this with their unique formula of delivering personal attention and high value to a huge, largely untapped market at very low cost. Their investors include Bloomberg Capital, Fenway Summers, and AXA Strategy Ventures. So enjoy my conversation with B. I am so happy to say today that my guests are Vinay Patel and Max Gassner from B. And it's wonderful to have you with us on Barefoot Innovation. Welcome.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
We are together at a conference, and I had the opportunity to get to know you two a little bit over the last few days, and to hear you speak this morning, Vinay, and I was so impressed by what you were sharing with the group. So what I'd like to do is start by asking you to each maybe tell a little bit more about your role in the company, your titles, and so on, and then to talk about your background and what brought you to this innovative enterprise.
Sure, so I can start. So I'm Vinay. I'm the CEO of the company, and I, you know, Max's brother Alex and I founded the company about 2 years ago. And I think the reason we started the company is because we saw this huge gap in the financial services market. In particular, we saw that for a huge share of the American population, something like 20 or 25% of people, the quality of retail financial services was abysmal. So a combination of inconvenient, not even present in some circumstances, high cost, uncertain, all made it so that folks in effectively the lowest 25% of income bracket had bad access. And we thought that was, in fact, a huge financial opportunity that we could potentially build products for and start to serve those customers. And so over the past 2 years, we have been working kind of tirelessly toward the mission of eventually getting all Americans on kind of high quality financial services.
I really want to come back to this targeting of the market that you've focused on. And then Max, you're the CTO.
Yeah, so my last company built cloud-based predictive systems, so machine learning systems, which was obviously in some ways very far removed. But the places I live, the places I've always lived, have been neighborhoods where there is a lot of alternative financial services. And so I've tended to be pretty exposed to check cashers and other things like that that maybe a lot of people kind of at the upper end of the income scale don't often encounter personally. And I kept passing them and seeing, you know, lines of people waiting to cash their checks all playing on their smartphones. And that seemed crazy because the smartphone is what you need to replace all that brick and mortar. And that was, I think, the nagging, ever-present friction in the world that, like, we kept coming back to as we were getting started, because it never made sense to us that that was how it was going to be forever. And as long as you see something in the world that just doesn't make any sense, you think to yourself, maybe we could be the people who make it obvious that doesn't make sense and change it.
Okay, this is great. I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but I want to get you both to just give me a little more background. You say you've lived at all the places you've lived. Where have you lived?
Yeah, so I guess I lived in parts of Brooklyn that were changing rapidly.
Is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up in Manhattan, okay. But on the Upper West Side, and it was kind of itself changing during the time that I grew up. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Manhattan today is there's still plenty of check cashers, but it's quite bright and shiny. But, you know, Crown Heights, Hyde Park in Chicago, I live in West Oakland now. These are all neighborhoods where there really are a lot of people who don't have access to banks. There aren't that many banks. Mm-hmm. And so what people turn to instead are these other institutions. And so you just become more familiar with them than maybe a lot of people who, even in financial services, don't kind of like have that lived daily experience.
Yeah. And I'm on the board of CFSI, and one of the things that we do periodically is give people a day out in the community with a task like to try to get a check cashed and pay some bills and that kind of thing. And it's such an eye-opener for people who are always, you know, working from the inside of financial services.
It's funny you say that. That's actually one of the assignments we will give a lot of our new team members in their kind of first week of onboarding. As an example, one thing I asked my chief operating officer to do when she started the company was to pawn something she owned at a pawn shop. And so I recall when she came back and she was telling us about the experience. And the thing that really stuck out is she said that she showed up and they walked her through the process in a very neutral way. So she never felt out of place. So as soon as she walked in, someone came up to her and was like, "Hey, what are you looking for? You know, we have a couple of different services." She was like, "I'm looking to check how much these earrings are worth." And then they were like, "Oh, why don't you talk to this gentleman over here?" And then the very little thing they did was after the gentleman took the earrings and then handed it back to her. And then they kind of continued talking. But the number of kind of seconds that he was holding was very short. And she recalled to me that that was a trust building behavior in the interaction that they had you know, made part of their process.
Isn't that interesting?
And, you know, for all of the kind of criticism pawn shops get, they have thought about their customer really well, and they have learned how to do things to build trust with their customer. And just, you know, small anecdote of things we do to onboard our team, but getting in front of both customers, but having the experiences.
So I want to drill down on that in a couple of minutes, because it's one of the things that really struck me in listening to you both through the conference and today is this, the way you're working the human interaction of this basically technology-based innovation. But before we do that, where are you from?
So I also grew up in New York, a combination of Staten Island, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Queens, all are places I've worked or lived. I, you know, went off to college and came back to New York. I did a joint law degree and MBA, both at NYU, and then spent 5 years. Right after I graduated, I joined the faculty at NYU in the business school, and I taught at Columbia in the public policy school. But that was only kind of a small share of my time. The majority of my time was at McKinsey & Company, where I was a consultant, and I worked mostly both for big banks and for the government and various kinds of public sector projects, you know, New York and DC and some of the East Coast states.
And Max, what were you doing work-wise before you started here? And how did you guys get together?
Yeah, so we've known each other for 18 years. So we have a powerful sort of fund of trust to build on. And our third partner is my brother. So three of us have known each other for a very long time. I guess I have had a little bit more of a checkered career. I was an institutional stockbroker for a while. I started on Wall Street in June of 2007, which was a really nice time to start if what you want to observe is the unraveling of a financial system up close. So I feel like there were some pretty valuable lessons that came out of that. But ultimately, that kind of finance wasn't for me. I moved to the Bay in 2010 and joined a little AI company that kind of ran its course, and then some of the people from that company started another company called Prior Knowledge. We had some really cool technology, we built some really cool stuff, and then sold that company to Salesforce. I was at Salesforce immediately before this. But the nagging sense that the way the crisis unfolded ended up kind of putting a lot of burdens on some of the people who were least able to bear them stayed with me throughout, and it is very satisfying to go to work every day and try to sort of do whatever we can to kind of redress that imbalance.
Yeah. So one of the things that made me really eager to talk with you is that I spend a lot of time with innovators. We have our podcast series and the other things we do. And one of the things that people sort of push back with is, but all this fintech is just for millennials and, you know, it's all very nice, but it's not going to do any good for, you know, average people or certainly underserved people. And you all are going straight at that segment with what you're doing. So I'd like to ask you first to describe what it is, what the product is, and then talk about the very interesting different way that you're going about selling it and getting people set up on it.
Sure. So the product today is a replacement for a checking account and a replacement for a savings account. So kind of specifically what that is we have physical stamps. If you think of it as like the equivalent of what a food truck might be for a restaurant, or the farmer's market might be for a grocery store, we are to a bank branch. So we are not, you know, on a website itself where someone comes to the website or someone just downloads an app, but we have a physical in-person presence, typically manned by well-trained experts on our product who go into low and middle income neighborhoods, both in New York around the city and in the San Francisco Bay Area, in both SF and Oakland. And if you were to come up to a B deployment, you'd see 5 or 6 people. You might be a little surprised as to what it looks like, and you might ask them, hey, what is this? And what they're gonna say is, well, this is B. B is a replacement for a checking account. It is a Visa debit card and a mobile app. Mm-hmm. And then from there, the conversation could go in a lot of directions, but it's probably gonna end up on a few really important things. It's gonna end up with a B expert asking the customer, how do you get paid, or what kind of income do you have? And how do you pay your bills? How do you pay your rent? How do you spend money? It's also going to end up with a discussion of what are the fees on the account, in which that B expert is going to use kind of CFPB model disclosure, which we have printed on, you know, 5.5 by 11-inch cards that we are in English and Spanish, and we walk the customer through. Mm-hmm. And then if the customer is interested, we'll take their information on an iPad, which is connected by 4G. We will hand them a debit card. We will help them download the app on their phone. And they're going to walk away with effectively a replacement for a checking account. And I say replacement because the underlying infrastructure is a prepaid debit card. But we have structured the fees and the features of this prepaid debit card to do almost all of the things our customers would be doing if they had a traditional checking account. And so we innovate both on the product because we have created both like a mobile app, which is uniquely valuable to customers, but we also innovate on channel because we have in-person conversations with people, but then serve them on the mobile phone. And so we're able to operate at a much lower cost than some of the other players out there.
What's unique about the product?
Well, a lot of stuff goes into the app design that, you know, it's little things, but taken overall, they make a big difference. I'll just point to like one. We had a hunch, which has borne out, that not everyone wants to be called by their legal name, and there are a lot of reasons for that. You might have not like your legal name. You might find that the gender you feel most comfortable in is not the one that you were assigned at birth, or you might just be kind of open to something like I want the app to call me by this emoji rather than by my name, mm-hmm. And we see incredible usage of that feature. And it's a tiny little touch, but it's a little thing about like treating your customers like people rather than, you know, the way that kind of often our customer base is treated when they interact with financial services, which is, you know, either as sort of a second class citizen, which is kind of what you get at the AFS providers, even though they're friendly, or as, you know, a criminal, which is often how you can feel when you walk into a bank branch if you, you know, don't speak English or feel like you might not have the right ID or have had bad experiences with the banking system before. So it's a little thing about treating people right. And we try to do that in every piece of the interface design. Surface what's important, make it really easy. On the product side, it has some cool features. We rebate some third-party ATM fees, and we don't rebate all of them. It's not, you know, we can't exactly afford that sort of like feature that you would get at a Schwab, but most basic banking accounts don't have anything like that. And so there are these sort of premium touches where we thought pretty hard about what to put in and what to take out. And I think from a sort of total cost perspective, it's very attractive vis-a-vis a basic banking account, but it also has a couple little things that make it feel maybe a little more special.
Hmm. And you mentioned earlier that one thing you found your customers want to avoid is overdrafts,
yes.
Right?
Well, they've had bad experiences with overdraft before, and they know how expensive it is.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, you know, overdraft is hard to predict. You don't necessarily know when stuff is going to clear in your account. When it does hit, it is very, very expensive form of credit. And when you start to have a conversation with a customer who has a basic banking account about the overdrafts they're subjected to, that's an easy conversation to have. And so, in a sense, one of the things it points to is that the low and middle income customer may not be unbanked or underbanked. Sometimes they're overbanked. Their bank is doing too much for them, like mm-hmm. providing this overdraft service. And you know, whole swaths of the LMI population, you know, are banked, have perfect familiarity with the banking system, but consumer choice is real, and if you can offer them something that's more attractive, we'll take it.
Hmm. One thing we've seen is words like poor are self-described words. People will say, I am poor.
Hmm.
And people will say, I am low income. But we have never once across, let's call it 20,000 live conversations, have someone say, I am unbanked or I am underbanked. That's a language that is only used by...
it's a policy language, yeah. And it gets at something, but
point.
If you're building the product for the customer, it's the wrong way to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
The right way is like you and banks and the pawn shop and the loan shark are actually all competing for someone's financial business, and they're going to do it anyway because no one is so poor that they don't have financial business to transact.
Right.
They will transact it with some provider at some cost, and we want to be, you know, we want to be the low cost, high scale provider where our incentives are aligned with the customer, and that's not something that's shared by everyone in the marketplace.
Yeah.
But what will, if we manage to do that, we will win, because just like any other customer, the customer is making choices.
So you talked today, Vinay, about some of the insights that you've developed about your target customer base, including their use of phones. Can mm-hmm. you share that? The observations you've made about the fact that a lot of people have more than one phone and how they're using them and so on?
There is something we knew in advance.
Uh-huh.
We knew that people would share phones. And so we made sure that you could have multiple accounts on one phone. So that we knew. But there are things we didn't know.
Yeah, and uh-huh. so the high-level principle is people optimize on both cost of device and cost of data. And so that's not too surprising. People typically optimize on prices across a range of goods. What's really interesting is the breaking of the phone into component pieces is really surprising. Mm-hmm. That is, when people think about many kinds of services they have, in particular financial services, you know, like I used to have my credit card, my checking account, my savings account, my brokerage account all at the same company 40 years ago. Today you might have ING Direct Online for savings, or now Capital One 360. Maybe you have a Chase for your checking account. Maybe you have an Amex for your credit card. Maybe you use Schwab for your brokerage.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a fracturing of the financial product.
Yeah.
But we're seeing refracturing of the phone product. And so what we see in New York is some people have government subsidized phones which do not have Android or iOS, but they do use them for voice and SMS. And so those are, again, free phones where the data is covered. And so they can kind of get voice and SMS for free. But they still want data-enabled internet and apps. And so what they do is they use very cheap Android phones they can get for about $40, don't buy data, and then use free Wi-Fi. And so between the free Wi-Fi phone, which is maybe $40, and then the government-subsidized phone, they can meet all of their kind of mobile needs, but now across two devices.
Yeah. I should say for our listeners, we have ducked out of the rain into a little room with a fireplace at our conference in Southern California, and I think we may be getting kicked out. So if we do, we'll pause for a moment and try to find another place. But so why don't you cover some of the highlights that you shared earlier today at the conference? They were really all fascinating to me. And Max, you join in as we go along.
Yeah, maybe I can talk a little bit about some of the beliefs we have on how regulation, particularly financial regulation, affects startups. Max, maybe you can share a little bit about how we think about design. But so I think, you know, we think there's kind of maybe four big principles, and they're kind of in order from least to most controversial.
Mm-hmm.
So I think least controversial is the notion that innovation has the promise of a ton of consumer welfare. Through different products, a lot of that kind of boost in consumer welfare can come in both non-monetary ways in addition to monetary ways. And that's kind of principle two. And so as examples of those non-monetary ways, some of that is, it's not just cheaper products, but it is transactions that clear faster. It is transactions where the prices are clear up front, as opposed to becoming clear after the fact.
Yeah.
Sometimes it is what we might call like a general outcome certainty. And this is what I think of as like this, the fear of pending. Whenever I see pending on any financial statement, I just don't know. Yeah. And I find that confusing and scary. And I think that is perhaps a widely held reaction to that term, because you just don't know what it means.
It's a scary term. And, you know, I think that one of the insights that's been evolving from research, including by CFSI, is the degree to which people's problems are just about these time gaps. Something's pending, you don't know when it's going to hit, and if you're tight at the margin, you don't know whether you're going to have the, you know, the money in the account when you need it, if you're trying to time your payments and so on. I think it's a critical issue. The slowness of our payment system is a big part of our problem.
Yeah. And I think as we continue to kind of go down this logic, as we think about like kind of maybe a third thought, it's that if we think about what regulation may do on the whole, any kind of reduction in innovation of startups is ultimately going to reduce consumer welfare. And that's not to say that every startup is good. Lots of startups are going to fail. But the idea that 1 in 5 or 1 in 10 startups can be successful, but then have a 10,000x scale over 2 or 3 years that returns a ton of value to customers. If we're not letting these 10 startups try, or if regulation stops those startups from making those attempts, that's not really good for consumer welfare. And I think that that leads to the maybe final point, which is, you know, there might be some controversy around, but we don't think so, which is that there is a real trade-off between actual failure and the existence of innovation. And so as we think about, you know, like today, we might be 1/100th of 1% of the market. And there's 100 startups out there just like us, and all together we're 1%. And that's probably even a stretch. All together, all the startups have a fraction of a percent. But if none of these startups are allowed to fail, none of them will exist in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so we cannot have a zero failure rate. And so the question that kind of we have to ask as an industry is, what is that acceptable tolerance? Because there is a dial, and as we say there is less and less tolerance for failure, there's going to be less and less innovation. And it is a real tricky question as to figure out where the correct social optimum is.
Have you given thought to, if you were in the shoes of the regulators, then how you would navigate that challenge? Because you have real customers, and if you have the failures we're talking about, there's going to be some harm or at least inconvenience to some of them.
So, you know, really broadly, I think we look to the regulators because most regulators have thought about this problem for much longer than we have. They've looked at more data and they're just generally more sophisticated. But I would say if I were to look at it from my particular unsophisticated viewpoint, things like carve-outs that say if you have products which meet X specifications, then there's a series of Y compliance and regulatory requirements which normally apply and those don't apply. Or maybe even that those can be done after the fact as opposed to before the fact. That might be, you know, some ways one could go about it, and I'm sure lots of people have interesting ideas. But in general, creating increasing stability and letting things be done after the fact as opposed to before the fact will affect startups in their willingness to try different things. And in particular, another thing I mentioned today is startups are very sensitive to their the early partnerships that are critical to testing their business hypotheses. And really anything which produces some certainty for partners of startups also goes a long way.
Yeah, including like banks, you mean?
In particular, financial institutions. But frankly, anyone who's willing to work with a new financial institution has to really worry about what that new organization is going to do, and when there are when there's regulatory guidance towards those kinds of carve-outs, that's one idea that might be helpful.
Max, any thing to add to that?
Sure. I mean, well, completely switching gears maybe, and talking about the design side.
Yeah.
Our third employee was a full-time designer. Not because there's so much to do in the app, although there's plenty. Not because there's so much to do in the collateral, although there's plenty. But what we're really trying to do is design the retail bank experience for this world where instead of having a large store that's empty most of the time that people kind of wander into or go to do their, you know, with something in mind that they want to buy, we have the upfront contact, we have the phone, we have the voice in the call center. Those are kind of the windows into our world that we provide the customer. Mm-hmm. And so we have to design this experience where that's going to feel like a bank. It's going to be the kind of thing where you commit to it and you stay with it for years and years and years, and where maybe you go back to that place if you need a future financial product, or certainly we hope people will one day. And so the things that go into that they range really widely. I mean, they range from everything from like doing user studies to see what kind of navigation is really accessible to our customer who, we're obviously in English and Spanish, but who may not be as comfortable reading, especially on a small screen, as like the mass affluent population, or who might have arthritis or other difficulties kind of with small touch targets on a phone. So that's one piece of what we have to kind of design around. We have to design physical collateral that shows respect for the customer and gets them excited. One thing you really don't want is that feel that you get with a lot of products that are targeted towards the bottom of the market where they feel really cheap and awful, because in fact corners are being cut everywhere. And so instead you go for a thick cardstock and a card that looks really good, because it is a source of respect and pride, and also, you know, we want to be able to take our card out and use it to pay a dinner, so it also has to look good enough that when it's one of a couple on the table, people stop and say something. And then kind of the broadest kind of design you do is around the interaction at the very front, where we put so much time into thinking through sort of what do we give the customer? How do we walk them through the information? You know, we don't want pages and pages of fine print disclosures. What we want to do is we want to walk them through stuff that is really straightforward, that is really honest, really trustworthy, but that also gets across the core product messages. We want them to take that stuff home and leave feeling like they've been given almost like a present. We want the card to feel right. And so that's kind of the kind of design work that we do when we're thinking about how do you take that old, the core of the old experience, but cut away everything that isn't central to it, which means, like, you don't need the big building. You don't need the tellers standing idle all day long. You need the human contact. You need the interaction to be good. You need to show respect for the customer everywhere that you meet them. But you take that human heart and then you kind of like move it into this new tech-enabled world. That's our job.
Yeah. And you touched on this a little bit, Nai, but I think another aspect of this that you talked about earlier is the fact that you've discovered that your customer base, you're not just designing for an iPhone 6. You've got a customer base that has all kinds of phones, different sizes of screens, different... So it's a challenge, isn't it? It's more of a...
Yeah, and on a daily basis, we will try to manage the problems of programming and building a code base which is running on both Android and iOS. On iOS, you know, we see a reasonable share going 3-4 years back. So, you know, iPhone 3s, 4s, 5s, and 6s. And on Android, it's a total explosion of device manufacturers, versions, ages of phones, screen sizes and screen quality, sometimes cracked screens, camera quality, sometimes malfunctioning cameras. And any of these can affect our product where, for example, in OneFlow, you take a photo of a check, you look at the image on your screen to verify that it's clear, and then you send it along to us. And that's a really complex flow, and there's a lot of potential pitfalls if you're not thinking about a robust process to one or many phone issues that may be different than a new high-quality iPhone 6S Plus.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You also talked today about the fact that your customers are, as they're bifurcating the way they're using their phones, They're living, they're finding Wi-Fi hotspots, and I enjoyed you talking today about the fact that since you've got one, you end up with everybody updating their apps when they're with you, and then you're taking them through the process of getting set up on the phone. Talk a little bit about that. So you've got the person has walked up to your interesting kiosk. You showed some pictures earlier. In fact, I'd love to put some of those in the show notes if you can send some photos like that. But you've gotten them interested. You start to have the conversation, and then sort of walk us through from there to when they walk away.
Yeah. So let's think about 30 minutes, right? So minutes 1 to minutes 10, it's all about customers are asking questions. We're asking questions to the customer to kind of learn about their needs. We are explaining the features of the product. We're talking to them about the fees. They're asking kind of the probing questions around how they might solve problem A or problem B, and we're walking them through solution X or solution Y. And that gets you to maybe like minute 10. And they're like, okay, I'm interested in signing up. So minutes kind of 10 to minutes 15 are the gathering of customer data. And so we're gonna take the customer's first and last name, their email, their phone number, their physical address. We'll usually ask the customer to input their own date of birth and social security number. For customers who are not, who don't have a SSN, we'll ask for a TIN, or if they don't have an SSN or a TIN and they have a physical documentation of, for example, a Mexican matricula consulare or a British passport, we'll actually take a photo of that document. And through that, and if needed, escalation questions, we can verify who that customer is. We'll then take out from one of the team lead on sites inventory, a physical debit card package. And link that debit card package to the information we've just taken on our iPad, and then hand that package to the customer, who then will usually jump on our Wi-Fi, download the app from the App Store or from Google Play, depending on if they have iOS or Android. They'll open that package, and inside is a debit card. They'll enter a passcode number that's on that debit card into their phone to effectively link the phone, the card, and the account. They sign their terms and their conditions on their phone, and voila, they now have a card in their wallet and a mobile app on their phone. And then from there, what we'll usually do is we'll kind of tour them through the app. Mm-hmm. For many customers who are interested in signing up for a direct deposit, we will actually fill them out a physical direct deposit card, which they can then take to their employer. So we kind of cut out some of those steps kind of to make it easier for our customers, help them through some of the frictions. If they are, a lot of our customers use the photo check deposit. One thing we have experimented with is giving the customers on the spot a small dollar check, so a $5 or $10 or even a $1 check, which we will write to the customer. And then they can actually experience taking a photo of that check, doing the front, doing the back, signing it, but kind of walking through the actual process itself. Interestingly enough, learning how to hold the phone to take a photo of check. One thing almost all our salespeople say is when customers take photos of checks, they hold their phone at an angle as opposed to pointing it straight down. And so we have to kind of show customers how to do that. And so now we're at kind of like, minute 22, minute 23. And then customers will continue to ask some questions. The account's all set up, but we'll tour them through the app. So we'll show them, for example, that once they have money in their account, they can put some of that money into what we call the B Vault. It's money that's out of mind, out of sight. Mm-hmm. People can use it for budgeting tools if they want to save towards some kind of goal. We can show them how to set their notifications if they want email or text messages. As Max mentioned before, we can help them set the name that the app is going to refer to them by. We can show them how to find ATMs around them through the app search function. We can show them how the billing, the automated bill payment system works. It's just kind of a range of features we will then talk them through. And then you're kind of at about minute 28, 29. Customer gets really excited. Sometimes a customer will want to take a picture. We'll take a picture with them, post it to our internal company dashboard, and customer walks away.
And it's really fun is the thing that's missing. there's selfies. There's kids around all the time. Oh, we give them candy, pens. So we have that old bank thing going. And the winter in New York is a little bit more straightforward, but in the summer it's really, really fun.
Part of what made me want to talk with you is that you're providing this human connective tissue between the interesting things that are going on in fintech and a population that people find hard to reach for whatever reason. I think maybe it was you, Vinay, today who said these are not customers who are just necessarily going to find a service online and vice versa. Or maybe if they find something online, it might not be a good thing. That's a whole other problem. But so you're doing this very human intensive upfront piece of it, and it seems to me it's been a missing link. I'm hoping that we're going to have more nonprofits and NGOs working with underserved, if I can use the term, consumers to do this coaching, you know, whether it's an elderly population or new prison people who are newly released from prison. Somebody came up to me after I talked one time and said, my population wouldn't know how to work with that. And I said, well, why doesn't somebody teach them?
Yeah,
you know, because if the tool would help them, but they don't know where to start. You know, this is what we need as human beings talking with people.
So we definitely have that there's a face-to-face interaction is a key point. I think for us comes out of two principles. And so principle one is that people are surprisingly similar. And so one thing that's always interesting for us is we talk to lots of investors, regulators, well-experienced executives in finance and technology. And so I'll ask you, like, what do you use for your personal bank account?
I use Big Bank.
What do you, Chase or Bank of America?
I use Wells Fargo.
Wells Fargo. And do you remember when you opened your Wells Fargo account?
Not vaguely.
Do you remember if you went online or you walked into a branch?
I think I walked into a branch.
Yeah, and so you are like almost all Americans.
Yeah.
Even young Americans who are tech-enabled, who are financially over-educated, who are experts in the industry, will still walk into a branch because checking accounts are super complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Checking accounts are really hard to compare to each other. There's lots of little details. And you don't know exactly what you need until you start to hear. And so it's not enough to just go to a website. Most people need to talk to someone. And we believe that's true for everyone. And so we actually think that while we're building a product which today is primarily being used by low and middle income Americans, it's actually a product that's going to be a great fit for a pretty wide swath of the American population because everyone wants to talk face to face. And I think there's a second principle in there, which is we believe that we can get scale because what we're doing attracts capital, because we actually provide good returns on capital. And so
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, certainly. So, we're a venture-backed company. Mm-hmm. We have spoken with a wide range of investors in the financial technology space. We were fortunate enough to meet some of the folks from Bloomberg Capital in 2014. And they led an investment in our seed round. We were also fortunate to meet some folks from Fenway Summer Capital, or some Fenway Summer Ventures, and Access Strategic Ventures, who with Bloomberg led our kind of more recent financing in 2015. But I think they and we collectively believe that if you can make money doing well, then there's lots of reason to make more money faster and do more good faster. And so we always try to think about not just, you know, the nonprofit roots, which, you know, we're certainly supportive of, but we ourselves want to be an institution that can not just provide value to customers, but returns to investors. Because if we can provide returns to investors, it's going to be viable to scale this up really big and really fast. And that is attractive from a total impact perspective.
Absolutely. If people can't make enough money to attract capital, these are always going to be small, maybe useful, but not high impact efforts. So what do you say when you hear people say, and I think we might have heard one or two of them in the last couple of days here, you can't make money serving people who have no money? What? Give us your retort on that.
I think we would say it's very hard to make money running a large, complicated network of mostly empty stores full of employees who mostly aren't selling anything. It's the cost structure. And, there are people who make money off of even the very poor. Alternative financial services is a huge industry. I think Arden's group says about $80 billion in revenue. you know, you could cut that very, very substantially and still have a very attractive target. And a lot of that revenue, you know, some of it is predatory, some of it really is just usurious, some of it is about trapping people in all kinds of unpleasant places, but a lot of it is just plain cost. And what mobile lets us do is be really careful about where we spend money. And it's funny because people mistake the friendly face for the unscalable component. The key is putting the friendly face in the right place at the right time. And if you think about companies like Uber and Airbnb, those are traditionally hugely capital-intensive companies. It's a car service with no fleet. It's a huge hotel chain, the world's largest hotel chain, with no fixed capital. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is they're linking available resources to demand in a really clever way, the right place, the right time. So if we can put our tellers, and they are tellers, they're better paid than tellers, but they're tellers, in the right place at the right time, and not have them standing around in the wrong place all the time, you know, in a gigantic building, that's the right way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, we know that people who are in this alternative financial sector pay a lot for financial services. There's a lot of data. There's one number of American Express quotes. It might be from one, it's from one of the regulatory agencies that say that there's a typical lifetime $40,000 excess payment for fees and for, quote, unnecessary fees and interest for just being in the high cost.
You think about overdraft at $35 a pop, a secured credit card where you have to put down $500 to start, or maybe you have like a $50 annual fee. You know, $50 annual fee can get a mass affluent person some substantial rewards. But if you're poorer, that's just more off the top. There's not at all a reluctance to pay or an inability to pay. There's a lot of really bad business models that we think we can maybe leapfrog.
Mm-hmm. And another, I know we're going to run out of time, but I wanted to touch on this. Another interesting thing that you've talked about is that you're able to cut down on some of your risk issues, including the anti-money laundering rules, because you're seeing these people face to face. So I think one of you said to me yesterday, you're therefore not the first choice of somebody trying to commit fraud because they have to show up and show their face to you.
Yeah, and so a fraud is always a super complicated problem. And, you know, we maintain incredibly high standards when we think about preventing both money laundering and financing of terrorism. But one of the things I think that gives us some comfort is if you wanted to try to create a large number of accounts on our platform and use those accounts to launder money, the level of effort would just be phenomenal. It would be impressive, in fact, if you could organize 400 or 500 people in a way that was undetectable to show up to physical locations which are moving around a large city in the middle of winter. And if that is the way you're going to you know, launder your money, you're going to get caught really fast. And so the combination of the really high cost of trying to attack our particular channel and the fact that we have, frankly, a ton of tools which let us monitor and prevent those in automated ways makes this fundamentally a lower risk business, certainly from our internal analysis, than some of the other business models we see in the market.
Like online, I mean, it's very easy to make fake accounts. It's really cheap. But it's really not, it's really expensive to do it in person.
Yeah. What haven't we covered that would be interesting?
I guess to me, the thing that's like most interesting about working here, working on this project, is just being reminded every day that the actual distance between the consumer at the bottom and the consumer at the top is more to do with some people having more money and some people having less money. And that's really the biggest difference. Our customers are they can take care of themselves and they make choices. Sometimes they make bad choices. Sometimes they make irresponsible choices. Sometimes they make thoughtless choices. But I don't think they make bad, irresponsible, and thoughtless choices any more or less than anyone else does. Mm-hmm. It's just that when you don't have very much money, there's not a lot of cushion to absorb the consequences. And there are a lot of products out there that make it worse. Some of it's malicious, and some of it is just, you know, limitations that maybe are going away. And we want to prove that those limitations are going away, and that we can build products that are better for people, regardless of whether, you know, who they are.
You know, I keep mentioning CFSI. One of the things that we've found in that research is that, in a lot of ways, the savviest people in understanding their finances are in this segment, because they have to be.
Yeah.
If you have lots of money, you don't have to pay that much attention. And there are certainly people who are sort of drowning in the confusion over it, but there are a lot of people who are right on top of their money. They know how much they have, they know how much they can spend, they know how much they have to spend, they know when their bill is due. And helping them manage that in a way that's got less stress, less cost, less reliance on these very, very high cost alternatives. It's just there's tens of millions of people in this category for sure.
Yeah, you say things like managing money, and you ask a wealthy person when they get paid, and they're not going to know.
Yeah.
And you ask a middle or a lower income American, and they know not just the day of the week or the day of the month, but typically what hour on that day those funds are going to clear. Mm. And they are optimizing their life around how many hours in the business day they have on that day after that payment clears, and what can get done, and then what can get done on the following days. And so people who get paid on 3 p.m. on Friday, they're thinking about what are they going to do with those 2 hours before close of business on Friday, because Saturday and Sunday they might not be able to make financial transactions.
Yeah.
Someone else who gets paid on a Wednesday has a little bit more flex. And if you as an employer pay people on Wednesday as opposed to Friday, that's really valuable. If you as a financial provider can help people get access to funds 1, 2, 3, 5 days earlier, that is seen by customers as a really highly valuable product feature or kind of overall ethos.
In a sense, having a lot of money buys you the right to be more irresponsible, mm-hmm. And a little bit less careful. Because
yeah.
One of the things that money will do is it just kind of fills in those rough corners. So a lot of our customers are more responsible. In a lot of ways.
I wrote a blog post last year. I think I called it Underserved and Underestimated. You know, that people sort of have this idea that there's a group of people who are just lost in the financial world, and really there's a lot of smart decision making going on. It's just being done in tough circumstances.
If you are going to underserve people, it's easier to think that it's their fault. and I guess like the truth is it really isn't. And maybe that will be more obvious once people are better served.
I'm excited to talk with you folks. I've been saying that all the problems people have in their financial lives, other than lack of money itself, are being attacked by innovators who are trying to pull these problems away in all different ways, from easy tools for bill paying and saving to things that are going to speed up the payment system and make it easier to manage the lags, to the something like after hours, you know, borrowing ahead on your own paycheck, that kind of thing. And there's hundreds of innovators, as you said before, working on all these things. And it's just great to see what you all are doing. We're going to be thrown out of our room here in a moment. Any last thoughts that you want to share?
This has been great to chat. I think as we think about the next year, we're always looking to hire excited, intelligent, hardworking people who want to attack this problem. And so if you know anyone, please refer them to us.
I'll do that. How many people do you have now?
The company is currently 13 employees across New York and California in our headquarters, plus another 15 field staff across those two cities.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both. Tell us where people can find BE, which it'll be obvious when you're looking at this on the website, but it's BEE is what we're talking about. Where to find you online?
Find us online at bcard.us. You'll find a list of real-world physical locations where you can find us for real. But do stop by.
Great, and come to our show notes at jsbarefoot.com. We'll have a lot more information there, links, some pictures, and it'll be great. So thank you both for talking with me today. I really loved it.
Yeah. Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Vinay Patel and Max Gassner, co-founders of Bee. Again, come to jsbarefoot.com for show notes, and we'll have much more information there on them, on Bee, and on the things that we talked about, including CFSI's research about consumer financial health, and also on the winners of the CFSI Financial Solutions Lab competition this year, other than Bee. The competition focused in this second year of it on solutions that can help consumers survive financial shocks. And please remember to send in your contribution. We suggest $1 a show to keep Barefoot Innovation going, and we will look forward to seeing you back here soon.